Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, Associate Editor for Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our Editor-in-Chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode, we are speaking with Dr. Susan Wood, President and CEO of Vida Diagnostics.
Susan has been with Vida for over 13 years. She is also currently on the Board of Directors for Presage Security and ICAD. With over 25 years of experience in bringing clinical solutions to market, Susan received her PhD from the Johns Hopkins Medical Institution's School of Hygiene and Public Health. In addition, she also holds a Master of Science degree in Biomedical Engineering from Duke University and a Bachelor of Science in Engineering from the University of Maryland College Park. So thank you for joining us today, Susan.
Yeah, it's my great pleasure. Thank you very much.
So can you describe your entry into healthcare from, you know, as we just heard, your engineering path?
So as you mentioned, my degree from Duke is a biomedical engineering degree, so it crosses over. But I would say that my first entree into entrepreneurship was at the University of Maryland as an engineer, and they allowed me to devise my own path, which was a combination of engineering and medicine as a undergraduate engineer. And that really was the springboard for me, because to go into subsequently into a biomedical engineering degree and then to go into the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. So it really has been the combination of engineering and healthcare. And it has allowed me to study, which is the most complex of mechanisms and machines, which is the human body.
Thank you, Susan. So as we said a few times now, you have your PhD from Johns Hopkins Medical Institution. For the work that you did in getting that degree, you combined quantifying three-dimensional lung structure with changes in lung function using high-resolution CT imaging. Why did you choose this area of study?
Well, oddly enough, as I entered Hopkins, I wanted to study cardiology and cardiac imaging. That was my goal. That was my plan. And my advisor at the time had a grant in pulmonology and in imaging of the respiratory system, and was proposing and doing really avant-garde approaches to studying the lung in health and disease using high-resolution CT imaging. So he had a grant. So that grant means money, and that was and so it helped fund my path. But I ended up really falling in love with it. And it was an absolutely perfect path for me at the end. The respiratory anatomy, it's a very complex anatomy. And its function is to take this complex anatomy structure, if you will, and its function is to exchange gas. So, you know, the analogy here is like a tree, right? The trees function and with the highly complex branching structures to exchange gas. So you have all of these, you can imagine like a great oak in the middle of a field. They have these, you know, a lot of leaves, green leaves. Their purpose is to exchange gas. It's kind of the same thing in the respiratory system. You have these highly complex and interweaving structures that allow you to exchange gas, meaning getting oxygen into the bloodstream and getting carbon dioxide from the bloodstream into to go out into to leave the lungs. And the gas to exchange surface of the normal human lung is about the size of a singles tennis court. So imagine that, you know, in the confine of a very small chest cavity, just an incredible structure. And I ended up falling in love with that structure function relationship with the lung. And the high resolution CT image at the time, again, this was the, you know, early 90s and mid 90s, was, you know, just coming into the fore to be able to find that those high resolution images to be able to measure structure functional relationships within the lung. So it's a good time to be there. And I've really carried that through my entire career as AI, computational speed scanners got better and AI incorporated into those structure function relationships got more advanced.
Can you explain that again? Not the whole thing. The tennis court analogy, what was that?
So your lungs, again, the purpose is to exchange gas, but that gas exchange surface, like is in your chest cavity, is when it fully expands, is the size, roughly the size of a singles tennis court. So that's how much, you know, if you look at the oxygen in the air there, how that is the uptake of that into your bloodstream. You know, it's about the size of a singles tennis court. And that's an enormous surface area for gas exchange in the confines of a small body. So it has to be a very complex interweaving structure to get to that high surface area for gas exchange.
That's amazing.
Imaging biomarkers and imaging use in clinical trials is something that over at ACT, we get a lot of submissions for, and we've covered a lot over the years. And some of the challenges that we see in this content include image management, using image core labs for those clinical trial processes and reads, and a few more. So my question is, what has changed in the field of imaging and images for clinical trials in the past 10 or so years?
So what's kind of the big high level things that I've changed, I think, is just the data revolution and cloud computing. So just the ability to get data, highly curated data, imaging-based, very precise biomarkers, and being able to incorporate that into the clinical trial process repeatedly and with high quality and high efficiency. The ability to have high compute mechanisms like cloud computing that enable this to happen. So that those two, I think, big market changes in concert are helping this system, and AI specifically. But I think that there's a couple of additional market forces and challenges that have been able to reap some benefits of this as well. One is that drugs in general are very expensive to get to market and have a high failure rate. So that's not a great model. That's something that can take information, data, and infuse it in the process to make that process better. Respiratory trials in particular, and which has been our beachhead, is they are the longest and the most expensive to get to market of, you know, different drug classes. And it's because of, among the reasons, because of the imprecision in some of the metrics and the endpoints. So it gives us an opportunity to incorporate better information, better data, more precision endpoints into the process to get drugs through that process with greater accuracy, a greater precision, and really to get to the patients that need them a lot faster. I would say that more recently, kind of what I would say as a forcing function on these things that needed to happen in the industry was just COVID. COVID has forced a lot of changes and has forced us to just rethink everything and the way that we do things, and not the least of which is how we implement clinical trials. So things like decentralization of trials, those inroads that I think the sponsors had been making for quite some time, that was certainly accelerated in the COVID environment. So I think those are the kind of some of the main, I think the main issues that were, I would say at a high level, it's just the ability to have data, the data revolution, highly curated data, and the ability to increase cloud computing and processing and the ability to get those data in a distributed way to the people that need them.
So one of your press releases mentions the 6-minute walk as a biomarker in clinical trials and how that may or may not be determined by lung function. And I think this is kind of what you may have been mentioning in your last answer around the endpoints and such, but can you describe the imaging biomarker, what it would look like for the 6-minute walk function, and in what other therapeutic areas would it fit in with?
Well, the 6-minute walk test is a generalized measure of exercise tolerance. So, and it can be attributed to changes in lung function. So it is an endpoint that's often used in, say, respiratory trials and other trials, because respiratory tolerance would be an indicator of a response. I think the issue is that the endpoint itself is fine, but it's very imprecise and it's highly variable. Think about walking for 6 minutes and the types of things that can affect that. You didn't get enough sleep. You have something else wrong with you. You had a bad day. You know, it's the morning versus the afternoon. All of those things could change and add to the variability of the 6 minute walk test. And then specifically, it just doesn't give you a high level of precision in your measurement. I mean, we're talking about in respiratory trials, measuring the thickness change of an airway wall of a 2 millimeter airway, a 4 millimeter airway down to, you know, and being able to measure that change. Well, in a change like that, you wouldn't be able to find that signal in a 6 minute walk test. You're finding a very precision measure that you would get an indication of disease drug response, for example, well before you would find any signal in a 6 minute walk test. So that's the advantage of the precision endpoint. You would be able to find result at a much earlier stage. And it's certainly something that you wouldn't get a signal for in a 6 minute walk test or other more generalized tests. You know, and I think that's the big advantage of the precision endpoint. And what it can do for your trial is it has great potential to reduce the subject pool, the number of subjects you need to power your study, because you're finding a response at a much earlier time.
Can you describe your virtual control arms and subject or patient matching services for the clinical trials that you offer?
Yeah, so this is a very exciting opportunity for us. And it's of high importance, but it also relates back to decentralization of trials and forces and changes as a result of COVID. What we've been able to accumulate for over a decade is a very highly curated database of disease-specific evidence. And what that evidence can show is it could mimic the natural history of a disease or a class of diseases and create a subject pool that would be virtual. So as a control arm, we would have data and the progression of the patient's natural history of any kind of disease, and that could be compared to a treatment arm. So instead of a subject coming into for a trial and getting a placebo, for example, we could use and augment that with our curated database of data that would mimic what the sponsor would want from that control arm. So I don't know if that makes sense, but it's a, you know, kind of a digitized person, if you will, that would mimic or align itself with what the control arm would be in that drug trial. So again, it gives the opportunity to reduce the subject pool, get fewer people to come in and do a placebo and reduce time and cost of that trial. So that's specifically on the control arm. I think you asked additionally about the subject and patient matching services. So finding subjects for trials is always a challenge. Again, it adds to cost and it adds to, failures of the trial or increased timelines. But the same descriptor, if we could find what the drug was looking for in specific subjects, we could find their attributes and be able to determine from, a routine clinical workflow, we found a patient that matches the requirements of that trial, and then be able to match and determine what trials would be available for a patient with those conditions. So we can find subjects using AI in an automated way, patients that would match the recruitment requirements for a specific drug trial. Again, to expedite that and to reduce costs and to be able to enrich the site and the performance requirements for that trial itself. So it's a very exciting area that we're using AI to be able to best match subjects for trials from a routine clinical workflow.
All important advancements for sure to help make it more streamlined for the clinical trials. And as you say, help the patient pool, patient burden, site burden.
I think the important things here to be able to use AI and intelligence and better information to infuse that into the process. And really the goal here, again, we focus largely on respiratory trials, which they tend to be the longest and the most expensive to get to market. We want to get therapies to these patients earlier, and we want to get them to be of higher quality and to be much more focused on which patients or subclass of those patients will respond or not respond. These are mechanisms and that we can use intelligence and intelligence services to be able to reduce the time, reduce the cost, and increase the quality of those trials.
So you offer services for physicians using your AI in clinical care. And how do you envision the future of bridging clinical research and clinical care?
So to the last example, we have regulatory approved AI applications that can be used in routine clinical workflows. And those applications could flag subjects that would be appropriate for a trial. So that's a way that we can take the experience we have and the implementations we have in the end user in the provider networks and infuse that information back for the sponsors to be able to create better and faster and higher quality trials. So we look at this as, you know, sort of a pulmonary or a trial ecosystem, right? We link that discovery model, which is getting clinical trials and getting trials to market, with the provider network. And the data from both sides is intermingled. So a drug is approved to market, for example, for a certain subclass of patients. But in the real world environment, you've found that it's efficacious for a larger class of patients. We can use those real world data and then back into the sponsors, for example, and they could increase or broaden their indications for use, for example. So it really is the data ecosystem, you know, enriches the entire, in this example, the respiratory ecosystem. The information can be used back and forth. One other example here is that when a drug is approved for market, we validated, for example, the biomarkers that would determine who would respond to that drug. And being able to determine who the responders are is a companion diagnostic or a companion to who in the clinical workflow would be a responder for that therapy in clinical practice. So if you're approved, if the drug's approved and there's certain biomarkers that say these are your responders, those biomarkers can and should be used in clinical practice to determine who should get the drug and when.
Excellent. Thank you. I wanted to ask you, like, what you see where industry actually is with AI, because as you mentioned, you know, the data revolution, the data sophistication, it's advancing as quickly as science itself. So where do you think we are on this AI curve right now? Like, is it like very, very early? Like, we've only just scratched the surface of what we can do with AI, or what is your opinion?
So I think very clearly we've only scratched the surface with what we can do with information and intelligence services. So there's some clinical applications that are using AI in routine clinical practice, for example, in screening mammography and stroke, high contrast stroke. They have reimbursement associated with those applications. But the promise to get more applications to be used in routine clinical practice is very, very high. And I think where we are now, very largely untapped. But infusing this in medical practice, I think it's inevitable. It's just time and process and a mechanism to do it. We have focused our initial applications largely on the e-pharma space and getting drugs to the market faster and with greater efficacy. And in doing so, getting the clinical validation associated with those drugs and using imaging-based biomarkers, for example, to get those drugs to market, because the validation component of the AI is critical to be able to be used in clinical practice. Whatever you're saying in AI has to have be validated that it has a clinical indication.
and it's a proven clinical indication. So a lot of times that's the delta between what's possible as a data scientist and what's possible, what is a true clinical indication. And using and validating these solutions through large clinical trials with the pharmaceutical sponsors is an absolute opportunity to prove the, and validate these AI solutions to be used in clinical practice.
So that's going to wrap it up for the questions planned for you. Like we talked about before, this is such a complex area and it was a lot of fun learning about it. And we really appreciate having you on. So thank you again.
Yeah, thanks for all you do.
Thanks, Susan.